to visit their daughter who's studying in Mechlala, so they came here. Yesterday, we had a full satmar in full regalia, and he tells me he's been listening to me for years, seemed very intelligent, well-to-do, perfect English, and family living here as well. So I've had a lot of excitement on the Sunday class. Where is Ellie? What's the story with Ellie?
Ellie Weinstein?
Yeah.
He's in the Ukraine.
What's he doing in the Ukraine?
Went to visit Graves.
Went to visit the quorum of the Hasidic masters.
With his wife at least? No, they're two little children here.
Do you believe that people do that?
My daughter did it. What do you want out of me? Yitzchak, you're a Litvak. I'm a Litvak, but I have enough seichel to try to understand that chassidim. All right, let everyone relax. Fine, we're ready to roll. Today is January 13th, 2020. And with all the heavy rain and the rain they predicted today, it's the sun is out and it's quite a beautiful day in Yerushalayim, even though it's the heart of winter. I want to say hello to the students in front of me and to all those listening, and a number of matters. First of all, coming back to yesterday's class, if you recall, I raised the issue, when do the chassidim wash at a fabrengen, at a shirayim? And our friend Avraham, our virtual Talmud who was here, who's a satma chassid, told me after class, I said, you should have said it during class. I want everyone to know. What they do is they eat a meal in their house and they wash al minat to continue the meal with the Rebbe. So 2 hours later, I don't know, their wives must bench, their children bench, and they go to the tish. And that's when the Rebbe cuts the challah, gives it out. There's no mass scene of 10,000 people going to wash at the same time. I also want to mention that the student asked me, in relation to mixed seating at the weddings, so you know the Ramah says with Sheva Brachas that there's no Shechinah, and there's a famous Levush who takes a much more lenient attitude that Bisman Hazel were used to intermingling with women. So I want to just tell you where the Levush is, if anyone should want the source, because this sometimes happens. It's not where you would expect to find it in Eben Ezra. It's at the very end where he added on a kuntris of minhagim, certain things that didn't go into the regular text. It's levush hachur minhagim number lamedvav. And that's the famous levush. It's right at the end, the last minhag. And I also xerox from my student. It's a name, maybe Charlie, you remember the name. Rabbi Ellenson mean anything to you? Getzel Ellenson. He taught at Bar Ilan. He was I think he came from Ireland. Or he was very close to Rabbi Koopman. And he died. He was, if my memory's right, in the early 80s, he was killed in a car crash or something. Died young. I met him on occasion. Very impressive. Big Talmud Chacham. And, you know, living in the Western world. And he published a 3-volume set, Teishava HaMitzvah. It's an excellent set. It was published by the Jewish Agency, the Torah Culture Department. And if you look into volume 2, on page 29, he quotes the Levush, and there's a long footnote with other sources with the interaction of social reality and halacha. And it's very basic, very basic. And halacha lemaisa, I've seen already Sheva Brachas where the Kala, the Chatan V'Kala are on two different sides of the Mechitza. They're not even there. But Al Pi Chassidish, but Al Pi Halacha, they're supposed to be sitting next to each other. And the whole question of mixed seating at weddings, but it's a very interesting source.
Is that a freebie?
Yeah, you can have it. It's the whole source there. Okay. Let me pick up where we left off, and I'll fill you in with the material in front of me. If you stay behind in the ghetto, you don't go into the big world, there's not much of a challenge, and life can move on as usual. When you come out of the ghetto, and the German Jews were the first ones to come out of the ghetto, Moses Mendelssohn, 1762, you face tremendous challenges. And will Torah survive in the world outside of the ghetto? You can do your research, you can take there's a nice Jew in Toronto. It's a Baal Tshuva. I got to know him very well. Very well, highly regarded medical doctor. And his father was raised the Gera Chassid. But the Holocaust out of the ghetto totally left behind any vestige of Chassidus, of Ger, Shabbos, etc. And this repeats itself 1,000 times over. You take a Beis Yaakov girl and you put her into Kalamazoo, Michigan. Will she or won't she? And this is the great challenge to Mechanchim. It's the great challenge to the entire Torah world today, because there is no Jew left in the ghetto. Even in Mea Shearim, which is probably the most ghettoized area in the world, nevertheless, if a kid walks out and walks a few blocks, he sees advertisements, he sees a different world, and you know what the percentages are, how many left, particularly before we developed an educational system that can somewhat, and I underline the word somewhat meet the challenge. Now, Moriu Rebbe, more than any other gadol who came to America, perhaps you can put the Lubavitcher Rebbe in the same breath, the same length wave with the Rav, these were people, Gedolei Gedolei Israel, who lived outside of the ghetto, met the challenge, and cast their rods way beyond narrow confines. And then you come to the problem of dual values. And all of us here, whether we like it or not, we have dual values. We're Jews. We're part of the Western world. Which value really wins out when there's a conflict? And we all went through this as kids. When the World Series takes place Friday night, Shabbos, Yontif, Yom Kippur. I mean, you can give many examples. And that's a minor conflict, but then you go into major conflicts. So we spoke last week about the Mara Nevuchim, and there's no question if you study the Mara Nevuchim, what the Mara Nevuchim is telling us, Torah had to be given at a certain time, and therefore there's certain laws, chukim, mishpatim, that reflect society at that time. Thousands of years later, can we innovate? And this is where we are challenged. You have to be a Talmud Chacham, what we can accept, what we don't accept, what we can alter, what we can't alter. And there are many examples right down the line. The simplest example is no one pays attention, Avelet Lo Aleinu, you're supposed to Atifat Rosh. And you see already the Achronim say it's Pratan Shulchan Aruch that we don't do it, the Goyim will laugh at us. No, the Goyim will laugh at us. I give a hoot about the Goyim. But the Rav said, we wear a kippah. This may be the Atifat Rosh of today. The fact that our head is covered. But you see, there's a certain alteration of what originally took place. But halachically, it's valid. There are more examples. You take women studying Torah. You can take the most extreme group in the world. Take Satma. Let's take Satma. The women today in Satmar get an education 100 times more than their great-grandmothers got 100 years ago. Right or wrong? The whole question, women, Torah, can they study the Chafetz Chaim? I don't think anyone is cliched that the Chafetz Chaim is not at Tzadik Yisod Olam. And you all know what the Chafetz Chaim wrote, that the Sugya in Soto, that was good at that time, but today, where the woman leaves the house, I mean, Chafetz Chaim describes it beautifully, and I frankly wish we could go back to what the Chafetz Chaim describes, that the father makes the shidduch, the mother makes the shidduch, you hand the girl over to the husband at a young age. Oh, would that solve endless problems? Aye, occasionally it didn't work, all right. As the Rav said, percentage-wise, it worked a lot better. He looked at the audience and said, then you're going out and finding your spouse on your own. All right, it worked a lot better. But nevertheless, Chafetz Chaim said, that's to Bizman Hazeh, if you don't teach a woman Torah, God, all she's going to be left with is real tiflet. So these are prime examples. The example we gave last week is crucial, and we're going to come back to it today. that the Rav a number of times publicly declared he never signed the Cheta Meir Rabbanim. And of course, this leads to the question, what do you mean the Rav didn't sign a Cheta Meir Rabbanim? Rabbeinu Geshem allowed for it. Why, what's wrong? The Shulchan Aruch brings it down. So much is written by the Achronim. How do you put 100 rabbis from 3 different communities together? What does it mean, 3 different communities? Does it have to be 3 different states, 3 different locations? Why didn't the Rav sign? But if I can go into Rebbe's mind, and Rebbe expressed it publicly, symmetry, if she can't, he can't. The Torah, when the Torah gave us a concept of marriage, it was surrounded by primitive society, like Kabanot. My example of Kabanot is right on. Kabanot, the Ma'amar Nuchim says, that's what people understood. So what God did, he didn't say, don't bring Kabanot. He elevated it. He sanctified it. But he understood that Jews have to bring Kabanot because that's the way they approached the divine. Their concept of their relationship with the divine involved Kabanot. So you take marriage. Marriage was a different sort of arrangement. You see in the Torah itself that Rachel and Leah give their maidservants to their husbands. No, would our wives say to us, here, take another woman and live with her? And as I told you, what I pulled in Machon Gold is classic. If for the good of the Jewish people, we should all have 4 wives and we could have 50 children. Wow, what we would do to take revenge from Hitler. But it doesn't go that way today. We expect something else out of marriage. So therefore, you can have more than one wife, according to the Torah. But Rabbi Geshem already saw that is not healthy, it's not desirable, it's not aesthetic, and it's not spiritual. Nowadays, the Rav said this whole concept of Meir Rabbanim, if the woman can't be married, the man can't be married. That was the Rav's approach. And if I can quote Rakefet, it whetted the appetite of people who were looking to solve these terrible challenges of Agunot, of women, of Mamzerut, etc. Now, Rabbi Rachman, we spoke about his life last week, comes from a distinguished line of rabbis. His father was very unique, a Rav in Albany who left the rabbinate, went into business, and succeeded. His father remained the first-rate Talmud Chacham, and the father said, my leaving teaching Torah in YU, he was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and he left it all. He said, this is our family tradition, 8 generations where we have only been business people, learning around the clock, but business people for Parnassa. And Rabbi Rachman, his son, Mendy Rachman, Emmanuel Rachman, he too didn't want to go into the rabbinate. He was a lawyer. By the way, he was a 1934 musmach from the yeshiva, so he had smicha. I checked it out. He had smicha from Rabbi Revel, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, probably Ramaz, if Ramaz died, I believe, a year later, but Ramaz and Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. They were the ones that signed the smicha at that time. Occasionally, Rabbi Leventhal signed. And as we saw from Wikipedia, he later asked Rabbi Belkin, who was 2 years younger than he, to sign the smicha as well. All right, so now we have Rabbi Rachman in the rabbinate. We have Rabbi Rachman, very active after World War II, becomes a chaplain, couldn't go back to being a lawyer. The Jews needed help, and he gets heavily involved in the rabbinate and becomes very, very successful. Shaarei Tefillah, Far Rockaway, you don't know what went on. Anyone from that era still alive will tell you, when we used to come to yeshiva Sunday morning, we used to get the guys from Far Rockaway. These were the wealthy kids who lived in Far. These were the wealthy kids living on the beach. And we used to say, what did Rabbi Rachman speak? What did Rabbi Pelkowitz speak? The White Shul versus Shaarei Tefillah. We used to compare the drashot. These were two fabulous speakers. One was YU, one was Torah Vidas. And Rabbi Rachman has a long career, 20 years in Shaarei Tefillah, then the organization of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Fifth Avenue Synagogue was a great moment. You don't realize it today. It was an attempt to organize a real shul with Balabatim, the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. In terms of money of today, the average Balabas there was a billionaire, not a millionaire. And yet they were from not only YU people. The president for many years of Fifth Avenue Synagogue was also the president of Torah V'Das. So it gives you an idea what we're talking about. People who conquered America financially, but these people were very solid, and they wanted a shul. They didn't want to walk all the way uptown to Kehillat Jeshurun. They didn't want to walk to the west side, cross Central Park. They wanted a shul on the east side, a very prominent position. And when Rabbi Jacobowitz left to become chief rabbi of the British Empire, Rabbi Rachman succeeded Rabbi Jacobowitz as the rabbi of Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Now, and he's very active in RCA. He's president of Rabbinical Council at one point. He's president of the New York Board of Rabbis at one point. And he gets involved with Russia, which we're going to talk about in length, but not yet. It's not only Rabbi Rachman. The RCA visit to Russia in the mid-50s, Khrushchev, a very important event. And Rabbi Rachman was a very unique individual, came out in favor of the JDL. Everyone today maledicts Meir Kahane as if the man was totally negative. And you don't realize there was a lot of positive to Meir Kahane. I don't have time to speak now. I did talk about him a number of years ago. It's a tragic figure, as I told you. Meir, two terrible events in his life that ruined his perspective, in my opinion. But Meir had a lot of great accomplishment. And like right now in Muncie, who can believe Muncie Jews are learning how to shoot handguns and pistols, and I saw some of them with machine guns or semi-automatic weapons. So JDL, Rabbi Rachman, came out and was in favor. But now we come to the start of the heart of today's lecture. And this is a very, very important topic, Yeshiva University. What is Yeshiva University? And here I got a question just this past week, a very powerful question. I can quote part of it, that here you have a Yeshiva University and you have a fabulous yeshiva, I'm paraphrasing it, and nevertheless you have a college program where some of the teachers are total apikorsim and filled with venom against Torah. And these are students, they're in the yeshiva, one of the various morning programs. Then in the afternoon, they're in college, all right? And in my time, in Yitzchak's time, I don't know if we could say teachers were filled with venom, but you took a class in English literature. I remember one teacher, every second word was a curse word. And all right, that's philosophy. Litman, if you read Rakefet Rothkopf's book on Rabbi Revel, so Rakefet Rothkopf reveals there an anecdote where they say Litman was a yeshiva bacher in his youth and he needed a job, it was the Depression, so he came to be interviewed by Rabbi Revel. Everyone knows Rabbi Revel had a hang up on tzitzit. He used to go to a kid, V'yazayah Yirat Shemayim, how is your Yirat Shemayim? Pound him on the back to see if he's wearing tzitzit. So Litman knew this. He came in with his tzitzit sticking out. So Revel was so enthralled, he was hired on the spot. It turned out that Litman was an apikoros, a nice apikoros. In other words, with a smile, not with hatred, with a smile, but an apikoros nevertheless. I had a teacher, you might have had him, Arfa. Milton and Arfa, Professor Arfa. But in your time, I don't think he was there. It's a, you meet the name Arfa. There are people in our world that are nephews, nieces, etc. So Professor Arfa was a JTS graduate who didn't, they drafted him, you know, had to be a chaplain. JTS said you had to go into the Army World War II, and he refused to go. So they had sanctions. They would no longer find a rabbin for him or a teaching position. So YU picked him up, he got a doctorate, and he was a very wonderful, nice person. So one time we're studying a Chara'am, And it was just unbelievable. If you know Acharam, it's Acharam's viewpoint. You don't know who Acharam was. Effie Acharam was a bucky in Shas and Paiskim. He was a Rav that was Masadi Gittin. His Gittin were accepted by everyone. But he wanted to go to gymnasium. His parents said to Chassidish people, his parents said to him, over our dead body do you go to gymnasium. You understand? So when his parents died, Hitaka went to gymnasium, became a Acharam. He was the controller for Vysotsky's tea in Moscow, so he made a good living, and he published endlessly, a cultural Zionist, with all that involves, it's not for now, and he had the exact conservative theory, Torah Shabbat prayers, a gradual development. You follow? Every generation alters it, adds to it, changes it. Have you read Solomon Schechter's book, Effie? You call yourself an Orthodox Jew, read Solomon Schechter's book, and then you'll know what you believe in and what you have to reject. Schechter, with the less they believe, the more the Bible went down. God, it's unbelievable. But that's what they believed. So Arthur is pumping us with the Acharam theory, and we are sitting there, we all knew this is what he was taught in JTS. That week was the Yahrzeit Shiur of the Rav. And the Yahrzeit Shiur of the Rav, the Haggadah, was totally against the Acharam and JTS and gradual development and all the problems that Arthur raised in class. The Rav dealt with it, not knowing that Milton Arthur, but this is the way it fit in. And we come into class and we tell Professor Arthur what the Rav had to say. And he was like this. He says, gentlemen, I might have my own opinions, but if that's what the Rav said, take him, don't take me. He was very good. But we were exposed, the cursing, the sex. There were teachers that anything you said, any innuendo, was like Freud, that there's nothing else in life except sex. All right, I don't know. I think I'm a normal person, but I'd hate to think that all my life, all that motivated me was sex. Yes, I got married, I had children, I lived normally, thank God. But Freud is not everything. So this is a very interesting question. And why does yeshiva, why does it function this way? So here I want to tell you, this is black and white, a challenge. What I think, and I say what I think, and you can find support from what I'm about to say in the second volume of the Rav. I quote Rebbe talking about it. It seems to me that what the Rav felt was that you have to go to a real college. The Rav uses the word, look what I have, it's in the second volume of Yeshiva University, you'll see. Look what the Rav said. I don't want a Catholic college. I want a real university. And I think that the thought behind it was, life is going to challenge you. What good does it do if we have a student 17, 18, 19, 20, 21 years of age, and you're giving him a secular program that has no real challenge? It's with a lollipop. It's sugar-coated. It's a sugar daddy. It's going to go out into the big world. It's going to be challenged. You're going to hear curse words all over. You walk the streets of New York. You ride in the subway. I mean, the way people speak, the F word is the most often used word ever. It's a noun. It's an adverb. It's an adjective. It's a verb. It's beyond words. And you got to know what this is the world. The enmity, the hatred, the challenges. The New York Times cannot say Shalom Rav if someone finds a problem with something in the Bible. Oh, it's on the front page. I believe that this is the Rav's feeling. I'm not certain it was Rabbi Revel's feeling. I believe, perhaps, again, these people are not alive to speak for themselves. The Rav, at least, you have what Rakefet published in... By the way, I say Rakefet, if I say I published, I feel that I'm being a braggart. So I refer to myself as a different individual. Forgive me. Other people may say, whoa, he calls Rakefet a third person. But all right, I was privileged to publish. The Rebbe actually alludes to it. Rabbi Revel, I believe, had no choice at that time to find religious people in America, people who could teach in college. There were a few, but not many. Isaacs, Husik, Revel brought them in. You could tell Ginsberg, who already was not totally from, but he was a Lamdan, he had learned in his youth, and he knew what Yiddishkeit was. Revel, but to make a faculty, bring a faculty, kulam Torah, Shorah, Mitzvah, it wasn't, couldn't be in Revel's time. In Rabbi Belkin, Rabbi Soloveitchik's time, it could be, but they decided against it, and I think this is the reason. Now, is it good, is it bad? Well, there's another point of view. Charlie is sitting here. Charlie went to school in Frankfurt. He went to the Reali school 150 years ago. Now, tell me, in that school, what type of teachers did you have? Rav Hirsch was very makpid, either a religious Jew or a non-Jew. You were never exposed to an apikoros. Rav Hirsch's viewpoint, follow me, Torim derech Eretz, it's all one unit. There's no dichotomy whatsoever. 51 years ago, 1968, a school was founded in Bayit Vagan, on Rehov HaRav Frank. A little building began, known today as the Academic Center Lev Academic Center. Not Machon anymore, they're heading towards university status. Zev Lev, German origins, Talmud Chacham, wound up in Toronto, running away from Hitler. Professor, genius in his field, physics, right? Am I right, Eli? He was in physics. Yes. Talmud of Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, very close to Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, who also wound up in Toronto, running away from Hitler at that time. And he founded Machon Lev, came in Aliyah when every Pras Yisrael, Hebrew University, Machon Lev, very different from YU. All the studies in Machon Lev are in the sphere basically of applied science, nursing, what do they call them? Startups, scientific. What Machon Lev has produced, they're graduates of Machon Lev who are multi-millionaires today. SodaStream, other graduates, buyouts, wherever you turn in Israel in high tech, you're going to find graduates of Machon Lev. The Army, the Navy, Tzomet, but in Machon Lev, no apikoros. It's not called the yeshiva, even though the program is simply based upon what YU innovated, half a day learning, half a day general studies, more or less half and half. Sometimes in YU we had more yeshiva than general, but more or less, when the program opens 51 years ago, they wanted to be certain that Rav Shach, who was the dominant figure in the Litvische Welt, would not put the program into Cherem. And Rav Shach was very worried it might turn out like YU, so he made a tanai with them, a tanai with Professor Lev, that they would never call it a yeshiva, they would not give smicha, it would be called the Beit Sefer Gevoha LeTechnologia. Now, in the United States, time moved on, and as you know, a Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Revel, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, a very bright individual, a man of vision, incessant energy, someone I knew very, very well, and someone who probably next to the Rav played the biggest role in changing my life, guiding my life, till I came in Aliyah, and then, of course, I get involved with I.A. Crow. And, of course, I'm talking about Rabbi Dr. Bernard Lander. Bernie Lander was a YU graduate. Bernie Lander was a successful rabbi. Bernie Lander had a PhD in sociology. Bernie Lander He was not called dean of the graduate school. I think he was called director at that time. They didn't have the title dean. But for all intents and purposes, he was the dean of the graduate school, Bernard Rebel Graduate School. And Bernie Lambda had visions, perhaps, of one day succeeding Rabbi Belkin. We're going to come back to Rabbi Belkin in a few minutes. It didn't work out, and he broke with yeshiva, and he organized Truro College. Truro College, the original concept was to have not Limudei Kodesh, but to have Limudei Chol that would help yeshiva people. The morning they could study in yeshiva, they can be in kollel, but they needed panasa, they needed a degree. Men, women, Beis Yaakov graduates, come to Turo, get degrees. But Bernie expanded way beyond that, and Turo College became an international institution. It's all over the United States. You'll find it in the New York area. You'll find something in Florida. You'll find something in Los Angeles. You'll find something in Chicago today. I don't know how many branches are overseas, but there's Israel, there's Italy, there's Moscow. I don't know if they're all functioning, but all over the world. And as Bernie said to me, I believe in Torah and Mada, but it doesn't have to be under one roof. And I also did great things. I'm solvent economically. I take money from the world, and the profit I pour into Torah. And Turo, because of this worldwide ability and remaining afloat financially, and underline the word afloat, very important, and Bernie is very right. It's hard for me to speak of him in past tense. We were very, very close. And I learned a lot from him. And he was very appreciative what I did for his Rebbe, not knowing at the time it was my own cousin. You follow? Today, I say to Bernie, you're thanking me for writing about Rabbi Revel? You should kick me out. I should take back my doctorate. I wrote about my own cousin. Blood relative. But Bernie, what happened was, and it wasn't in the original plan, it gave birth to a real yeshiva. A yeshiva rivaling Reitz. You all know it today. It gave birth to a yeshiva, what's it called? The one in Kew Gardens Hills, Torah Chaim, Eitz Chaim, what's the word? Give me the word for it. There's a name for the yeshiva there. That is a real yeshiva. You want to go to college, you go to Queens, you go to Touro, etc. But it gave birth to a real yeshiva, Landa College. And Landa College is modeled exactly on Yeshiva College with one tremendous distinction. There is no upper courses taught in the college. The courses available, and they do have psychology, they do have some of the social courses, but all the courses are taught by Jews who are Yoreim Ushleimim. You aware of this, Dov? Yeah. Tremendous difference. If Rav Hirsch walked in to Landa College, he would be very happy. When Rav Hirsch walked in to Yeshiva College, he was furious. No, Yitz, fill me in. What am I talking about? Who saved Rabbi Joseph Breuer's life? And no one denies it. Rakefet published it, the sources. I have correspondence, Jacob Breuer. Who saved his life? Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel wanted him to teach in Yeshiva College. He was an expert in Bible. It would have been fabulous. He walked into Yeshiva College. He saw their teaching Acharaam, their teaching Bialik. He walked in and he walked out. Thank you for saving my life. But this institution is not in accordance with the way I was raised. And Landa College, wow, he would be very happy there. And here,
for example, they also have
Solomon
Seifert.
Right,
Solomon
his ancient ideas on Torah Baal Peh and how it developed. And
so he went
And he went to dropsy afterwards.
It had tremendous influence on YU because the people who taught Jewish history were all graduates.
Bernard Rebel graduates. It wasn't so much in YU, but Bernard and Dr. Regis, Dr. Honig, etc.
They all went to dropsy,
correct. And all right, that's an open question. Here you are, my dear students. This advertises YU. This advertises Lander College. You look at them, read them, you'll see the difference right before your eyes. When Lander College began, two of my dearest friends were pulled away from Yeshiva University. The founding Rosh Yeshiva of Lander College, Rabbi Abba Braunspiegel, who was the leading Rebbe, Rav Yehuda or Julius Parnas. We knew him as Teddy. He should live and be well. So I spoke with Teddy, said, why are you leaving Yeshiva? What's the big advantage of Lander College? He said to me, when they hire a professor for the general studies, the rabbinic faculty has veto power. We have to meet the man, we have to see his publications, we have to see his lifestyle, we have to give our okay for him to teach. And here you see, this is a conflict hitting you right between the eyes. How do you view it? Kid of 17, 18, 19, going out into the big world. Do we take this kid and prepare him for what the reality is? Or do we keep him within the tent and give him enough background, learning, enough groundedness in what Chazal call, what the Rama calls, Bus of the Yayin. Shem Malay Kreso, Bus of the Yayin. Look into Hilchot Talmud Torah. And if he has the good grounding, he'll be able to handle the world, to get rid of the crumbs and keep the good cake, the good bread. And this is the question. This is how I understand it. And this is why you until today has not changed.
So what does
this
have to do with
Hold on 1 second. I'm developing something. Well, it has to do, first of all, with the challenge of the big world. How do you respond? This is the heart of the issue. But this is an open question, very fascinating. I can tell you in my time, every few years, they go to the Rav and complain about Greek mythology. Right? Have you ever studied Greek mythology? Robbers, murderers, killers, rapists, seducers, the gods. What are we studying it for? And the Rav would always say, without understanding Greek mythology, you can't understand the Western world. And boy, do I understand the Rav today. Look at our leaders. Look what motivates them. They're like gods. If the gods can do it, then you have the average people. Look what's going on in Israel today. Look what we spoke about yesterday. Rabbi Peretz said, my children were raised normal. Boys marry girls and girls marry boys. The country was shaking as if he denied our right to the Holy Land. I don't know, as if he denied that we're breathing air. That's normal. Boys marrying boys and girls marrying girls, that's just as normal, it's fine, it's wonderful, transvestite, and not all that goes with it. So this is a very, very, how do you prepare for the world? All right. Now, one of the most important figures on the yeshiva scene who's totally forgotten today is Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. Rav Shmuel Belkin, this man's life is worthy of a Hollywood movie. Comes to America running away from Europe, totally impoverished. He basically learned in Rotten. Spent some time in Mir, evidently, but really Rotten. He was a Talmud of Reb Mendel Zaks, the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law. A Goynisha cup. comes to America, can barely speak English, 1928, arrives in Canada, had an aunt there, winds up in New York a few months later. He needed a place to feel at home, and Yeshivas Pascal Chanan had just opened on the campus, 1929, uptown, and he's at home, he's in the Beis Medrash. And within a few years, this immigrant who could barely speak English has a PhD from Brown University in Rhode Island, and his PhD on Philo, very interesting topic, a Jewish philosopher, the Bible, how much did he know, was he from, etc., is published by Harvard. Could you imagine the Harvard University Press? 1935, he comes back to New York, and he becomes a Rebbe in the yeshiva and professor of Greek and Latin in the college. He was the most beloved Rebbe in the yeshiva. The students related to him. He related to the students. It was a tremendous, tremendous love affair. Now, Rabbi Belkin becomes dean of the yeshiva, and as you know, there was a tremendous contest for the presidency. Basically, there were two candidates above anyone else. I've spoken about it in great length years ago. One was Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, and one was Rabbi Dr. Mori Rebbe Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. It was the Rav's dream to become president of the yeshiva. It was like this was made for him, a first-rate Litvisha Talmud Chacham, a PhD from the University of Berlin, president of the yeshiva, Rabbi Dr. Young. And I told you, on the streets they used to say, I still heard this a few years later, if Rabbi Young is elected, there'll be no yeshiva. If Rabbi Soloveitchik is elected, there'll be no college. The truth is, they're totally wrong on both levels. But what they meant, Rabbi Young was more of a German. He was a Hildesheimer product. He was not a Litvisha. And the Rav, his basic gestalt was Torah Hashem Tamima. The college was a necessary part of life because we're in the Western world. Well, a few years went by, it was a bitter struggle, and finally people woke up. We have Rav Shmuel Belkin, Talmud Chacham, PhD, quite young in years, born 1912, make the Cheshbon. In 1943, he was elected the second president, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva University. And this man had a tremendous vision. Listen carefully. I'm the only one in the world that can tell you this, because I heard it from the people directly involved. His vision was way beyond the little yeshiva and the little college, a university. We Jews have benefited from America. We have gained from it. We have to repay America. And build the university on that level will contribute not just to Torah and the Jewish world, but to the greater Western civilization as well. After he was elected president, Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, and the dean of the college, Jacob Hartstein, make believe you've heard the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise, one of the Hartstein brothers. These were early graduates of the yeshiva. Each brother, one was head of public relations, Sam. One was the dean of the college, later the founder and president of Kingsborough College, a community college in Brooklyn it's located. And there's another brother was in the rabbinate. I think he was Abraham Hartstein, if I'm not mistaken. It can be checked. Very successful brothers. And the Rav is talking with Jacob Hartstein, standing outside the Beis Medrash, what you call the Harry Fischel, in my time it's called Harry Fischel Beis Medrash. Is that the same name today? Good, okay. So, and Dr. Belkin comes out of his office, which was right up the stairs from there, and they meet Dr. Belkin, they give him Mazel Tov, and what are your plans? And he says, no, we're going to build the university. It's not just the yeshiva. We're going to be both to the Jews and to Western, to the United States civilization. We're going to have a medical school and many graduate schools. And Jacob Hanstein told me when Dr. Belkin walked away, the Rav and Jacob Hanstein broke into laughter, and they looked at each other, this man is off the wall. What dreams, what dreams. Well, this man accomplished everything he dreamt about, and even more. With it all, he was a most fascinating personality. I always describe Rav Shmuel Belkin, you could feel schizophrenia in him, in a positive sense. On one hand, he was a Litvish Talmud Chacham, the man's knowledge. I remember when Dinner de Malchut, the dinner, when I did my project postdoctoral, and I had a talk with him and the Rav in learning, oh, what he knew, I was blown away. And on the other hand, he was a man who could sit with Einstein and tell jokes. There's the famous picture of Albert Einstein and Samuel Belkin, big laughter on their faces, terrific sense of humor. He once gets up at a dinner where Cardinal Spellman is there, and he says to Cardinal Spellman, I mean, this is classic. He says, Cardinal Spellman, Your Excellency, whatever they called him, we both are wearing skull caps, but there still is a big difference between us. Your skull cap is red, but your institutions are in the black. My skull cap is black, but my institutions are in the red. And he was a Gomel Chesed, what he did for the refugees, for the Shanghai crowd. I can go on and on detailing it. And there was nothing he loved more than a young man who showed promise of becoming a Talmud Chacham, a leader, a doer for Torah, for his people. And maybe that's why he found an affinity with a young, stupid kid named Donny Rothkopf. You understand? I was closer to Rav Shmuel Belkin in the 60s. He was a distant figure then. I'll explain that in a minute. And I was closer to him than any other student. There are reasons why a little bit I write about in Washington. I could tell more, but it's not for now. Now, here we have a tragedy today. And let me explain myself. You have Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman's work on the early years of Yeshiva, 1886 to 1915. You have Rothkopf's work on Rabbi Revel, which essentially covers 1915 to 1940. Fine. Nothing has been done further. And I have cried and pleaded and spoke to people. And then recently I'm getting feedback. I showed a letter to Effie, who's related to the family by marriage. I showed a letter, and I've gotten a number of letters. How can we write about Dr. Belkin? He was a drunkard. I couldn't believe my eyes. That's in the letter. So let me go on record. It's as if, what are you telling us to write and not tell the truth? I want to tell anyone spreading this rumor, and unfortunately it's coming from a younger generation who did not know Rabbi Belkin, you don't know what you're talking about. It's just the opposite. A work has to be done on Rabbi Belkin. The archives have to be accessed at Yeshiva University. My student, Dr. Shulamit Berger, in charge, will be tremendously helpful. I'm alive and kicking. I can help to a certain degree because I knew Dr. Belkin and I understand the relationship with the Rav and the Yeshiva and the Rosh Yeshiva. I myself was appointed a Rosh Yeshiva by Rav Shmuel Belkin. What is true, and this is sad, that the man, his vision, the problem of the red black kippah ultimately overtook him. Yes, his kippah was black, the institutions were in the red. And this has been the curse of the presidency of Yeshiva until today. 90% of the time of Rabbi Belkin ultimately had to stop giving his shir. You talk about what happened afterwards in the last 30, 40 years, Rabbi Lamb. Even today with Rabbi Berman, the fundraising is the greatest challenge these people face. We have a tragedy. You have Jews like Bloomberg give $2.2 billion to Johns Hopkins. What that could have done for Torah, a Jew, $2.2 billion. Ultimately, all that has to be written in the doctorate, and you'll see now how this ties in with Rabbi Rachman, all that has to be written in the biography, that by the 1960s, the burden of the yeshiva affected Reb Shmuel Belkin's health, and he sustained himself. You came into his office, coffee, cigarettes, and occasionally a shot of liquor. That's what has to be written. No one is hiding facts. But to use the word, he was a drunkard. You don't realize who the man was, what he accomplished, and what he did. But at the end, his health was compromised because of this tremendous burden. And Ein Mazal Yisrael, I can give you a simple example. The late 60s, there was Rogozin, a very famous name. There's a high school, where's it, Ashdod or Ashkelon, the Rogozin High School, Jew doing fabulously. And then he turns to Yeshiva, and $1 million, this was not small money. At that time, Mr. Grush gave $1 million, Mr. Rogozin. And what did he want? Rabbis don't have ethics. Right away the Balabatim find a problem with rabbis. If not for rabbis, Jews wouldn't be here. So they don't have ethics. So Rabbi Belkin sat down with Rogozin. They brought the Rav in. The Rav was a tremendous, you know, he didn't have to say a word. The fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik sits at the table with you, that means give $1 million. And they established an Institute for Ethics, the Yeshiva. 10 people were chosen, yours truly among them. New, go on Wikipedia, check out what happened in 1969, the tremendous stock market crash, and Rogozin was wiped out. That $1 million, the only one who got paid out of that whole Rogozin Ethical Center is yours truly. How did I get paid? It's also a miracle. I went in Aliyah July 5th. It's before the right before the crash. So I spoke with Isidore Twesky, Rabbi Professor Twesky, the Rav's son-in-law. Rabbi Aaron was there, Professor Twesky, the Rav, Dr. Belkin, etc. 10 of us together, Jerry Blitzstein, I believe, etc. So I told him, listen, Yitzchak, I'm going in Aliyah. I need every penny. I was a poor kid who had money. Who knew what awaited me in Israel? So I said, I know, I was the first one who presented the paper. It's been published. It later was published in Tradition. It was republished many times in South Africa. They republished it. In Florida, they republished it. They're all different societies. And I republished it again in Raka Ferrara, and I think it's Chelik Aleph, probably Chelik Bet. So I now had to make certain changes and give him the final form after presenting it in front of Reb Shmuel Belkin and Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, etc. So I told Yitzchak, I need the money. So he said, look, I'll see what I can do. I'm supposed to get $1,000. I got $750. About a year later, I met Yitzchak in Israel, and I say to him, Yitzchak, where's the other 250? My paper was accepted. It's going to be published, etc. He says, Arnie, you're the only one who got anything. Rogozin went, Mechuna. It's all over. And boy, I looked at him, I said, well, I got $750, a schut for going on Aliyah. All right. Now, this little description, and halavai, halavai, we should have an authoritative doctorate in Rabbi Belton, because what I'm coming to, I'm working, I didn't live in America already, I was out, but I'm working from memory. Part of it may be right, part of it has to be fine-tuned, it has to be worked out with the archives. By the mid-60s, it was apparent that Reb Shmuel Belkin needed help in running the yeshiva. One man cannot do it alone. You know, today, Rabbi Berman, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, my student, graduate of the Kollel, has a whole crew under him. So they started to look around, someone who could be an alter ego to Rabbi Belkin, could assist him. Someone who knew the American Torah scene. Someone who had contact with wealthy Balabatim. And let me be totally honest, the first one they thought about was Rabbi Mafshewitz. Anyone here from Queens? Anyone know? What's it called? Hillcrest. Hillcrest. Hillcrest, right on the border of Jamaica Estates and that area, a very large conservative temple. At the time, when we say conservative, it meant mixed seating, not anything else. The rabbi of that shul was the Mechita Eloi's son-in-law. Rav Shlomo Palachek's son-in-law, Rabbi Mafshewitz. The street, the square there, is named in his memory. You see a big sign. And he was personally Orthodox, 100%. But as Mrs. Revel said to me years earlier, she said that Gedafstein Frumer, he should be a lot more frum than he is, considering who he's married to and where he's coming from. So Rabbi Belkin felt very much at home with him. Rabbi Belkin knew him. They were friends from the 1920s, the late 20s. But you see, by the mid-60s, this could not go over. Rabbi Mafshewitz, a conservative temple, American Orthodoxy is waking up. The swing to the right is beginning. Could not go over. And they had to retract the idea, the offer. Rabbi Mafshewitz was not the man. Who did they turn to? Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman. Logically speaking, Rabbi Rachman was like a glove on a hand. Rabbi of Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Don't have a more prestigious position than that. Rabbi who has contacts daily with men who light their cigars on $100 bills. What's a $100 bill to a billionaire? Rabbi Rachman, Talmud Chacham, lawyer, professor of law, writer, speaker, orator, right man in the right position. And he became Rabbi Belkin's assistant. I would love someone to do research and come up with the exact title. As I recall, it was special assistant to the president. They did not yet use the title vice president. In Wikipedia, they say that Rabbi Rachman became provost. I don't think that's correct. I think that the provost was later Rabbi Belkin, at a later stage when they were looking for a new president. But all this has to be researched and worked out. And here, a few years, Rabbi Rachman in the position, I remembered like yesterday, I still was at yeshiva. And then there was murmuring time after time that Rabbi Rachman is an innovator. He was publishing, he was speaking. The concept of Hafgat Kedushin didn't happen overnight. But I remember saying to my students when I read Rabbi Rachman's writings, articles, publications, and I'll show this to you, if not today, next week, black and white, I always felt he was walking on the border between left-wing orthodoxy and right-wing conservatism. All right, nothing wrong. This was his viewpoint, this was his thinking. He personally was 100% observant. His shul was 100% orthodox, to say the least. But he did have some open-minded theories at times in halacha, psak, Gedolei Yisrael. He was one of the real firm leaders who came out against the 1956 psak not to allow synagogue council or board of rabbis. And you have to remember, that became a burning issue, the most divisive issue on the Torah scene in the United States. Today, I think that issue has more or less resolved itself. It's disappeared from mainstream. You all know that the synagogue council disbanded more than 20 years ago. I don't know how powerful the New York Board of Rabbis is, but it's not a player. It's not one of the featured. When the New York Times has to write about Judaism today, they have to go to Agudat Yisrael. They have to go to Lubavitch. They have to go to the OU. I don't see them going for a statement from the New York Board of Rabbis. But at that time, that was a major issue. And there was opposition to Rabbi Rachman. In relation to Rabbi Mofsiewicz, they couldn't get off the floor because he had one tremendous problem, one kupav shrutzen, to paraphrase Chazal, his shul was nominally conservative. You couldn't get away from it. There was no mechitza. But Rabbi Rachman, Talmud Chacham, Fifth Avenue Synagogue, but left-wing tendencies. Why is this so important? As Rabbi Belkin takes ill, this already is in the 70s, they finally reach the conclusion there must be a new president. There has to be someone who can work for the yeshiva 724. And now, tremendous problem, talking mid-70s. Rabbi Belkin is alive. You don't want to push him aside, but he's not well. So they come up with the idea to make him provost. And all this has to be checked out. I'm working from memory, being 6,000-7,000 miles away from Washington Heights at the time. Remember, I'm living here, this is the 51st year, 69 to 20, make the cheshbon. So who'll be provost? President. And one of the prime candidates, and logically speaking, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman. The man, the dream of yeshiva. Rabbi, PhD, Talmud Chacham, lawyer. The dream of what we want to accomplish. What a track record. By the way, his wife, fabulous lady, Ruth Fishman, the niece of Rabbi Leo Young. When they got married, 1930, Rabbi Leo Young officiated at the wedding. Well placed, three beautiful sons, raised wonderful children. That you give credit to the woman. I always say, my wife raised wonderful children. Don't give me credit. By the way, Vic, my wife was very moved by your gesture, so be aware. And Rabbi Rachman, a prime candidate. No, what happens next? Who remembers? The world was shaking. There was a committee appointed to vet out candidates and reach a conclusion who should be the next president. And the committee went to work. One of the members of the committee was my classmate, well known to you if anyone's looked at the New Tradition. The hero, the star, the genius, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, known to his students as the Grach, what do they call him, Professor Grach, Dr. Grach, PhD, Dr. Gon, Rabbi Chaim, very interesting individual, probably the greatest Talmud Chacham ever raised on American soil. Rabbi Baron Cutler, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, no one raised a son with the knowledge that Chaim has. It's unbelievable. It's a Soloveitchik mind. Wow. All right, he went into Chochmat Yisrael. He's a blend between traditional Talmud Torah and scientific Jewish scholarship. You look at his magnum opus on wine, Yeinam, it can't be equal. It's the gold letter in Chochmat Yisrael today of rabbinic scholarship on a scientific. It's a terrific synthesis between learning and scholarship. You want to know how to make wine? Go to Chaim. It's the greatest expert on how they made wine in 1100, 1200. You want to know what Chazal had to say about transporting wine, goyim, touch it, etc., go to Chaim. He'll give you every shita among the Rishonim. This guy is top quality. Said Sherman, the yeshiva's royim, you understand? No one understood him, but the man, all right. Chaim came into a meeting and he brought in Rabbi Rachman's book, One Man's Judaism. And people described to me, because I had a student on the committee, people described to me how the book was marked off, underlined. And Chaim said, look what this man says, Apikorsis. Look here, this is what we want. And that negated any chance that Rabbi Rachman had for the presidency of yeshiva. All right. What happened afterwards is very simple. He went on to find his home in Bar Ilan. Went in Aliyah. Believe he was president and chancellor. I saw him in action. He put Bar Ilan on the map. When he took over, it was a small institution. Many years later, I'm scholar in residence in the Beverly Hills community. They're sitting shiva there for someone who died. All right. The person sitting shiva only happens to be a billionaire many times over. And on Pico Boulevard, I meet Rabbi Rachman. And we embrace, we know each other decades. Sons Chavruto. And I said, what are you doing here? And he told me where he was going. Lenachem Avel, this person that sitting shiva. Eli, you understand? He went Lenachem Avel. That brought in a new school, a new building, and I'm not playing for Bar Ilan. He put them on the map. He found his home. But yeshiva, It couldn't get off the floor. It couldn't work out. It couldn't start the opposition. And look where it's coming from. You're talking about Chaim Soloveitchik. This is not Charlie Hexter or Aaron Rakefet. The last name, Soloveitchik. Read the new traditions. It's 25 years since his rupture and reconstruction. And many articles analyzing it. And Yitzchak, it's very fascinating, that first article. And there's a lot more in there. We can discuss it sometime. It's not for now, but ultimately, Chaim Soloveitchik's theory works in reverse as well, 25 years later. What was the heart of his theory? That people, that people follow a written text. They don't have a mimetic tradition. They can't look. The Holocaust divided the world from what was a normal act of Judaism, that you saw what your friends and parents and family did. Yeah, they started reading. And out of the reading came a lot of chumras. But today, 25 years later, out of the reading came a lot of coolers. How many of you saw the weekend freebies with the advertisements? How many of you saw Makari Shon, Rabbi Riskin Shudoff, Lindenbaum, now Rabbi Kenny Brander? No, do you guys read or not? They just announced a new program for women. 5 years of intensive study and you get Heta Hora'ah. Manhiga Ruchanit. Heta Hora'ah, Manhiga Ruchanit. And they're reading the text. Dov, they're reading the Chafetz Chaim, the Likutei Halacha, Sota. They're reading. Very interesting that what Chaim had to say 25 years ago, today works both ways. But it could very well be, and I acknowledge a letter I received from a very fine individual who was related to Rabbi Rachman. It goes back, related socially and figuratively and perhaps family, and knows Rabbi Rachman. This individual is not my age yet, but catching up to me. And he knows Rabbi Rachman for many, and his father knew Rabbi Rachman, and his uncle, there's a whole interaction there. And this individual, who's insightful, wrote to me that he feels that Rabbi Rachman's talk and Hafkat Kedushin and the explosion with the Rav, it was 1975. By that time, Rabbi Rachman knew he could not be president of the yeshiva. Rabbi Rachman might have reached the conclusion, let me say what's on my mind. I don't have to hold back, censor myself, guide myself. Two more conjectures. First, the timing was such that Rabbi Rachman may have borne the brunt of a public stance by the Rav that was inevitable. Wrong place, wrong time. Too much was trending the wrong way in those days, and it was inevitable that the Rav would take a stand. That he was the target might have been an accident of timing for Rabbi Rachman. There's a lot of depth to this paragraph. And let me end off with the explosion. We've come a long way today. This challenge, how do we go into the big world? How do we deal with two sets of values? How do we deal with Torah Hashem Tamima? And a Western world, the New York Times world, the Haaretz world, the general public in the center of Israel, Tel Aviv, Ranana, Hod HaSharon, these communities, Givatayim, Ramat Gan, God have mercy. Western world, democracy, freedom of choice, individuality, no coercion. Rakefet, you're a fanatic. We have nothing against you going to Shul Shabbos. We have nothing against you learning Torah day and night. But why do you force us to sit in our homes on Saturday when we want to go to the beach? Why can't we have buses? We're not telling you to get on the bus. But Kefet, you're a fanatic. This lady, her father was Jewish, her mother wasn't. She came in Aliyah, a little girl. She speaks Hebrew better than you do. She served in the army. She risked her life. And you say she's not Jewish? She doesn't want to convert. Doesn't want. I just read. Russians say, we don't want to lie to the rabbis. What do you want? She's a good Israeli. Why can't she get married here? Why does she have to go to Cyprus? These are real challenges. How do you handle it? And see how Rabbi Belkin's life, it intervenes with Rabbi Rachman. Could have been a different world. Had Rabbi Rachman gone on to become president, there wouldn't be the big Bar Ilan today. Yeshiva would be a little different. It could be Rabbi Rachman could have brought in heavier money from his crowd. But if, it's the biggest word in the dictionary, Chaim Soloveitchik's appearance, and it was described to me with the one man's Judaism that I'm going to quote from next week, sentences underlined. And in 1975, it came to a head. And here I have to tell you what happened, and once again, I thank Manny Holzer, Zichrono Livracha. I had the tape sitting in Jerusalem. I was there. First, there was the RCA convention. Inevitably, at RCA conventions, the clock was never on time. Whenever you have a public convention, you tell a speaker, you bring in a world-famous speaker, you tell them 1 hour. No, 90% of world-famous speakers have a tremendous ego. You jerks are telling me 1 hour? What the hell did you bring me so many miles from Israel to speak? Go fly a kite. I want to say something. It's going to take me 2 hours. I want to say something on a level. The RCA convention that day that Rabbi Rachman was one of the featured speakers on the Aguna problem, which was now headlines in America, they finally reached him like 11 o'clock at night. So he spoke very quickly, very fast, and abbreviated his talk. And I heard the talk. I had it on reel to reel. And he brought up Hafkat Kedushin as the solution. Let us do it further. Let us do it in more cases. It can solve many problems. I think you know I may be an Amoritz, but there's certain topics, if I can quote what they used to say in Litta, there was an expression of Tes Sugya Keminish Zagin Vasakhenish. And this Sugya, there's nothing you can tell me that I don't know already. Maybe an Amoritz, but not of Kod Kedushin. Look at Chelik Dalit Rakafet Aram. It's quite a topic. And there was Havkot Kedushin. Any kid who learned Gemara knows it. The Sugyan Gittin, you learn right away. I learned it when I was a kid. Sugyan Baba Batra, Sugyan Yuvamot. It's all over the place. And Rabbi Rachman said it quite clear. That's our solution. Retroactive annulment of marriage. Call her Makadesh, Al Dat Rabbonim Makadesh. Okay. The Rav did not hear his talk in person. And a week or two later, there was a convention, an alumni, a conference, I think we can call it, not a convention, it was a Chad Pami thing at YU, Yeshiva University Rabbinic Alumni, YURA. And the Rav got up to deliver a paper. He was the featured speaker. When those years, the RCA, YU, if the Rav was not the featured speaker, No one showed up. When the Rav was the featured speaker, you had a magnet attraction. So upstairs, I believe it was in First Hall, I'm pretty certain, the Rav spoke, a few hundred Rabbanim, and he was supposed to speak on Geirut. He barely touched upon the topic. I can tell you, there was Divrei Torah on Geirut, I know it, but it's not for now. And the Rav said, I have a very unpleasant task to discharge today. And he said, I was told that a certain rabbi proposed Hafkat Kedushin, and the Rav went on and on, cutting off the branches of the very tree we are sitting on. And this far-reaching concept that any time there's a problem in a marriage, the Rav said, absolutely cannot be justified halachically. If we could solve it so easily with Hafkat Kedushin, remember what I said a few weeks ago when I introduced the topic? Why do we have two prefim at the end of Yevamot and the longest siman in Shulchan Aruch, siman Yud Zayin Eben Ezra, which is endless? And I'll add that millions of pages of responsive literature have been written on the topic. All we have to do is say a woman doesn't know where her husband is, retroactively annul the marriage. And the Rav was adamant. And as I told you, Manny Holzer claims, I didn't see it, that he was sitting there and shaking his head to the Rav, stop, stop, don't kill Rackman like this. And the Rav went on and on. He was motivated beyond words to make his position clear. And he spoke in terms, and we touched upon this a week or two ago, in terms of the lonely spinster, that all the rabbinic enactments cannot change God's creation, ontological, that a woman who doesn't marry alone suffers, unlike a man who can be a bachelor and happy as can be. And by the way, in modern Hebrew, it's amazing because we say ravakach chamutza. And when you come to a ravak, you can say ravak aliz. You follow? There are men, stupid guys who never married. Ah, they're in their 70s, 80s, happy as can be. Vic, I'm not, and nothing personal. I'm talking in general. But in modern Hebrew, ravak aliz, ravakah hamutza. And the Rav said nothing can change this. And this has halakhic implications because tavla meitiv du and all that we spoke about, and look up all the sources in Rakafet Aaron Chelik Dalet. My dear students, it was a head-on collision. I need not tell you, by the mid-70s, the swing to the right, powerful. The world is changing. Even in the mid-70s, if people would have told us that in 2020 there are going to be 92,000 people at a Siyum Shas in a football stadium in New Jersey, you would have think he's crazy. But at least then, you could say, there'll be a Siyum Shas in Brooklyn, the basketball court, 20,000 people. It was beginning. Freezing. My nephew was there. Other people I know were there. Freezing. I saw the pictures. Everyone bundled up. It looked like they were in Russia. It's a miracle they didn't get sick. In 4 hours, five people had to come tell the security, come early. Oh my gosh, Baruch Hashem, I learned Shas, but I do it in the comfort of my home, I'll put it that way. And between Mincha and Maariv and Shul. What a clash. The right wing took the Rav, turned him into a hero. Mata stuff, there was the publication, I have it in my possession. It was like a publication. I used to get upset when I saw it in my bed. I said, what are you? I called them once. I raised hell with them. It's like you're Catholics putting out information, evangelists putting out information, the light. I said, how do you use a title like that? The light. But the light translated the Rub's talk, published it word by word in English, with a whole introduction, quoting the Gemara, Bini Mamsahu, that the Rav declared his student, not really his students, his father's students, Rav Moshe, Mamsa. All right. I need not tell you. Rabbi Rachman was very hurt. He's only a human being. And the Rav taking him on in public and everyone talking about it was not a happy situation. And this story plays out. On one hand, the Rav's Talmidim, the 70s, which was the last decade that he really had Talmidim, that he really could teach at, the Rav's Talmidim, by and large, from the 70s, you'll see them much more right than center. Rabbi Rachman goes on to Israel, goes on to Bar Ilan, and becomes a great devotee of innovation vis-a-vis women and agunot. Until today, at Bar Ilan, there's a tremendous center named in honor of Ruth and Rabbi Emanuel Rachman that deals with women's issues and follows all the psakim of the Batei Dinim in Israel, provides lawyers to Anot Rabbanim, provides female rabbinic lawyers, provides help and guidance to Agunot throughout the world, but particularly in the state of Israel. Now, let me leave you with one question. How do you know that my analysis is correct? I'm only a human being. No one has really researched this topic. We desperately need a doctorate on Rabbi Belkin, on the yeshiva, on this period. Rabbi Rachman certainly will play a role in the doctorate dealing with the 60s into the 70s. How do I know I'm correct? Number one, next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, Rabbi Rachman will address the class. And you'll hear his words. When you hear his words, I think Rabbi Rubin is going to say, Ani, your interpretation seems to be correct. But that's for Rabbi Rachman, Charlie. How do I know I'm right about the Rav? Do you know Yomo? Everyone in this class should go over to Yomo and ask Yomo, give him your email address, and ask him to send you what he took from my personal email with my permission. Talmidim of mine took a snippet, about 9-10 minutes, from a talk the Rav gave. It has to be a Yahrzeit Shiur, late 60s, early 70s. The Rav is still in his prime. It's not the 50s, but still fabulous, unbelievable. Problem, though, is it's in Yiddish. But it may be Dr. Lustiger, Arnold Lustiger, someone did the translation of the Yiddish into the English. The Rav is talking about one little sentence, La'asok b'divrei Torah. When you hear it, it is beyond words. It's Rav Soloveitchik in his prime essence and existence. And you see the Rav. He outdoes Rav Aaron Cutler. He outdoes Rav Moshe Feinstein. He outdoes Rav Shach. You can give any name you want. What he says there, you're blown away. You're blown to heaven. Yomo made it available to Rabbi Avishai David. Rabbi David didn't know how to thank him. You'd better tell Rabbi David to thank me, the source, creating the students. You don't know how much of Rakefet went into this. Effie, you better be sure to tell Ellie when he gets back from the Ukraine, praying for his namesake. Oh my gosh. Gentlemen, I think I have it right. Check it out. I hope people are listening across the world, and there's one bright youngster who has the guts, the desire to do a proper dissertation on the Belkin era. We have one volume called The Belkin Era by Vic Geller, but it's a memoir. It's not total scholarship. That volume can be used as part of doing a PhD thesis, but it involves the archives, working it out, perhaps a few interviews, and you can come up with a volume that people will say, there's Klapperman, there's Rakefet, and now the Belkin era. And in 20 years, someone will be looking around to do on Rabbi Lamb. The history, crucial, important. My dear students, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for honoring me with your presence today. Yes, Yitzchak?
It's interesting that the Lord never mentioned Rakefet's
name. No, he didn't mention Rakefet's name.
That, I think, was a great indication of a certain respect.
But on the other hand, everyone knew who he meant. I have been told that at the RCA, I know the talk by heart, and the Rav was, wow. He was traumatized. But you see, Chaim, this all has to be written up, and there may be, in the YU archives, you may actually have what Chaim said. You understand? There was a committee. And I only know about it because Joey Epstein was on the committee. I mean, that's how I know details. And he told me the whole story. And Rabbi Rachman, until that moment, was a serious candidate. And that moment ended it. It gave the way to Rabbi Lamb, who turned out to be a very blessed choice. Charlie, have you heard yesterday's shiur yet? The middle of the shiur. You haven't gotten to the end, and you didn't hear what the Rebbe pulled on the Talmudim. Whoever wants a copy. No? You see what it is? The Lubavitch water. I made a number of copies. Anyone want? I made 5-6 copies. It's the halacha. Let's see if anyone deals with it halachically.
Jack?
If anyone wants. This is another copy of the Mishnah Brura. I was born before my times. Gentlemen,
you
get no schar for Lima Torah. This is hand feeding you like a baby, like a baby. Anyone who wants to see what they're doing. Now, this is very interesting.
I think it's made in Israel.
Yeah, no, it's all the Americans living in Har Nof and Beit Har Elit, they make panasa by the translations. This is Beit Hillel. You know what this is? Beit Hillel is an organization that's the most left of all the rabbinic organizations in Israel. It has, again, women and men paskening together. They're probably making a shechiyanu that Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Branda, heter hora manhiga ruchanit, Dov, in your smicha, it doesn't read so beautifully. It says, yore, yore, finished, big deal.
You know that Rachman wrote an article in the Jewish Week years ago. In which he said that it's a matter of sociology that in 50 years women would be rabbis.
Okay. I'm not going to argue with him. It's going to happen. The question is, will they accept him? Okay. Anyway, this was just published by Beit Hillel. It deals with foreign workers, how you have to treat them. Very interesting. It deals with someone incapacitated. You have a non-Jew taking care of you. Can you eat the food he cooks? Okay, these are real tremendous she'ilot. I have to give them credit there. This is what I offered yesterday. No one's interested. We'll try again. This is chavruta, and it breaks my heart. Pluralism and pardes, and what happens in pardes, and orthodox, reform, reconstructionist, conservative. Here's a lady learning Gemara in pardes. So you understand what I mean?
The question is, what's going to happen in the future? He's going to be like conservative.
There it is, right there. The Economist, anyone interested in money, this is, I'm told, is considered the top magazine in the world dealing with economy. And it's fascinating how they rate Israel. We're way up there. Crown Heights, under God, under siege. It's about the group, what's it called?
The
Yeah, the what they call the angels, but what's their guardian angels? Guardian angels, along with Hasidim, are now patrolling Crown Heights. Believe me, Ellie will need it in Lakewood soon.
JDL.
No, it doesn't exist anymore. Here's a tremendous march across the Brooklyn Bridge, solidarity for New York's Jewish community. This, I believe, is from the New York Times. Let me just make one comment. When I was growing up, we marched for Soviet Jews. Today, the Jews have to march for themselves. Who could believe it? Very interesting article from the Atlantic. Putin blames Poland for World War II. Putin, could you believe it? And you got to see the whole article. This is also very interesting. Safat's disappearing tourist scene is boomed for ultra-Orthodox. And it's about how all the hotels have disappeared, and all you have in Safat today is from people, Hasidim, and it mentions the hotels that have closed, and the most prominent hotel discussed in the article is the Rakefet Hotel, where I stayed in 68 in Safat with RCA. You'll read the article, Rakefet Hotel, and it's a shame it closed, because I could go there and say I deserve a discount. The name Rakefet. This is about the church, what happened in Georgia, and how people are coming to church with guns. It's unbelievable where we're at today. Whatever you want, yeah. And the truck driver's minion. This is about Satma Kiryat Yoel, the success and the non-success. Unbelievable to read here about people full of Shabbos and frum, raised frum, and they can't leave the frum environment. But they're no longer from. They meet Shabbos morning, 12 o'clock. Some are davening, some are talking, some are drinking, some are getting drunk. And here, once again, this is on the Rav, that they're now studying his Yiddish tapes, meeting once a month. But the only way you can come, this is in New Jersey, the only way you can come is if you know some Yiddish. Unbelievable.
Why do we do that here in Israel?
Give it time. In 50 years, it'll all be in Hebrew. And if we won't be here, our children, our grandchildren, can I inherit? Halavai, they should be interested. I want to thank everyone for their participation. Until we meet again in health and happiness next Sunday, I have one more tshuva to deal with. The Shabbos Mun Kiddush, the drinking, and I'm going to show you the Hasidic influence in Tshuva that you would never find in Reb Moshe or any Litvakin, and probably the Hungarians are not Hasidim, wouldn't write like that either. And then we go into one of the oddest, funniest Tshuva that have ever been written. I think any other posek wouldn't advance it, but Reb Menashe Klein answers. When you lose your hat under a parked car on Shabbos, how did you get it back? Okay? That's Reb Menashe Klein.
You're talking about $300-$400 hat?
Of course, of course. He's as serious. It's a serious question. Ellie, I want to talk with you for, Effie, I want to talk with you for a second until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vandalia. And I want to greet Professor Ellie Rothkopf. We bear very similar names, Aleph Rothkopf, Aleph Rothkopf. We are not blood related, but we are socially related, having been in the same Merkaz Klita 51 years ago. Ellie, if you'll step into my office, I'll give you a copy of my latest Sefer, which has some importance to it, Be'ezrat Hashem. Kol Tov.
Dr. Grach and One Man's Junior. He took the book and overnight went to the entire. Isn't that, do I remember correctly?
That's what I was told, but I.